The Sopranos changed television. The HBO series was centered on mobster Tony Soprano, a deeply flawed male anti-hero. That then innovative approach cast a long shadow and would be duplicated by many shows in the years that follow, series like The Shield, Breaking Bad, and House of Cards, among others.
Its debut also coincided with the rise of Netflix's original DVDs by mail service, making it among the first truly bingeable television shows. But the thing that really set The Sopranos apart was the fact that Tony was in therapy, a genius touch that granted viewers special access to his inner conflicts. I'm Aisha Harris.
And I'm Glenn Weldon. As we prepare for a new prequel movie, we're looking back on The Sopranos in this episode of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision. Kind of like choosing to listen to your favorite song on repeat. And with their top-rated app, you can deposit checks and transfer money anytime, anywhere, making Capital One an even easier decision. That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Capital One N.A., member FDIC.
Joining us today is writer and film critic Shay Vassar. Welcome back, Shay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Always great to have you. Okay, now we are going to be talking about The Many Saints of Newark on tomorrow's show, but we thought the best way to prepare for that was by talking about The Sopranos and taking some of your questions about the show. The HBO series ran for 6 seasons, beginning in 1999 and concluding after 86 hour-long episodes in 2007. Created by David Chase, it followed New Jersey-based mobster Tony Soprano, played by the late James Gandolfini. Tony's struggles with work-life balance weren't like yours or mine. He led a fractious mafia family filled with colorful characters who were forever beefing with other mafia families in and around the New York metro area. Edie Falco played his wife Carmela, who mostly looked the other way, pretending to ignore the mistress's murder and mayhem of Tony's world, as long as doing so kept her and her children comfortable. And then there were Tony's sessions with his therapist, Lorraine Bracco's Dr. Melfi. These scenes gave the writers several opportunities to emotionally unpack both Tony and Melfi separately and together. The Sopranos helped position HBO as a source of quality original content at a time when its reputation had rested on shows like Dream On, ask your parents, and Arliss, ask your straight parents. It was at once a prestige, nuanced character study and a violent, pulpy, sometimes literally pulpy soap opera that delivered genre thrills to its increasingly online audience, who gathered on message boards to speculate about who'd get popped next. And yeah, don't worry, don't stop believing, we are going to be talking about how it all ended. Aisha, let's start with you. What is your relationship with The Sopranos?
Well, I just finished The Sopranos for the first time earlier this year.
Oh.
It's fairly new.
Okay.
I was definitely very much a latecomer to the show. And I think part of the reason for that was because when the show originally aired, when it premiered, I was all of 11 years old. And HBO was also definitely not in our house. Like, my parents were not paying for the premium cable package back then.
Right.
By the time I got to college and it ended, I just wasn't checking for that show and no one I knew was checking for it. But I did know how it ended because it was impossible not to know how it ended if you were just online or if you were reading any sort of newspaper. And it was that show that everyone was talking about. I think that's partially why I put off watching it for so long. I was like, I know how this ends. I don't know if this is going to be satisfying. I know everyone says it's the greatest show of all time or one of the greatest shows of the last some odd years. But knowing how it ended, I was like, nah, I don't know. I have to say, it is worth it. And even when you know exactly how it's going to end, the characters are so fascinating. One of my favorite characters is probably Meadow, just because she is woke white woman before we knew what woke white women could be, or before we had a name for it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
For your information, crime is an economic issue, not a racial one. White or African-American, you're more likely to steal if you're in a lower income bracket, which most African-Americans are.
Good, then you'll feel better when the next one takes your car stereo.
You are such a hypocrite.
And the way in which her arc occurs throughout the seasons is just really, really fascinating to watch. I really enjoyed it, even knowing how it ends, and I probably enjoyed the ending better, like actually watching the ending, than people who seemed to like it when they were watching it in real time, because I actually think that it's a stroke of genius, and I think the show is good, and I think that there are some things about it that have not aged quite well, but there's a lot of it that has, and I think the people saying that it's one of the greatest shows of all time. I get it. I can say that I get it.
Cool. Now, Shay, you were nodding when Aisha mentioned the fact that she knew how it ended. And did you also? Because you came to it later?
Yeah, I came to it later. I came to it probably 2017. I had moved to New York and I was just catching up on all the shows that I hadn't seen before. And The Sopranos is obviously one of them. I was, oh gosh, what year did it come out? Yeah, I was young. And my parents definitely, we were in the middle of nowhere, Oklahoma. So it was already hard enough to get cable, much less any kind of premium channel. So I had no idea what it was about until I started watching it, really. And I thought it was so brilliant because I imagined what the pitch room looked like of this idea of, yeah, we have this mobster who needs to go to therapy, right? Like, it almost sounds like a start of a joke. Mm-hmm. But it's purposely uses its different techniques in order to have this really interesting commentary on things like racism, toxic masculinity, immigrant diaspora, especially generations removed from the immigration, not knowing how to belong to anything but what your family has taught you. So for me, I just felt like it was something that I could dissect over and over and over again in a way that television had never done for me before. I had seen Mad Men before that. Mm-hmm. And I can see how Mad Men is similar. And I love Mad Men. Don't get me wrong. Brilliant show. But The Sopranos is, personally, I think it's on a whole different level.
I agree.
Okay. Now, it's interesting that both of you talked about what you love about this show. And neither one of you mentioned, you know, explicitly the mob stuff, the whackings, all that stuff. And I'm going to come from the same place, even though I was watching it in kind of real time, a little bit delayed because we had the Netflix DVD because we also didn't have HBO. This was the first series we ever binged. We had just gotten Commitment Ceremonied. We were in the nesting phase. So we would spend entire Saturdays, entire Sundays in bed watching our Netflix Soprano DVDs, eating too many pints of Starbucks Java chip ice cream. And I have no regrets about that. I'd do it again.
No cannolis? What?
No cannolis, right? No.
Tiramisu, something?
I haven't done a rewatch, but man, preparing for this show, I can feel the itch. And that has nothing to do with the plot. That is not, because when we were watching it, you know, I knew all the major players without a scorecard. But coming from the outside after this many years, it is like a Tolstoy novel, yeah. Man. It is almost impossible to get into. But I was struck by how many of the things that I love about the show that I remember about the show have nothing to do with the mob stuff, because this show is incredibly, on a human level, well-observed. And it's often a very funny show. Like, there's a moment when Christopher is trying to be a screenwriter, and he runs into Martin Scorsese, and he shouts after him, "Marty, Kundun, I liked it." And Kundun is such the perfect pull. It's so funny. There's a plot line, I think it's even only in just one episode, where we learn that Junior Soprano's willingness to perform a certain sex act marks him as somehow unmanly. Mm-hmm. That just so perfectly captures the wildly illogical way that toxic masculinity works. And when you learn that about this culture, you start to look at every heterosexual relationship on the show in a new way. And you're like, oh, and you see all these women, you're like, I knew you were miserable. And last thing I want to say, speaking of well captured, can we all around this virtual table hold hands and agree that AJ Soprano, Tony's son, is the worst?
Yes. Oh my God.
The absolute worst.
Like, even before he's like understands exactly what his parents are involved with, even when he's at the youngest age, he is such a little twerp. I can't. Ooh, and I went to school with like middle school. I had to deal with those kids and
She's not coming.
Who?
Grandma just called. Started crying and hung up.
She needs a purpose in life.
No, your mother is tougher than you think.
So what? No.
Hey.
Everyone knows that kid. A horrible kid who is doomed to become a horrible adult. He's entitled, he's stupid, he's lazy, he's sullen. The thing that I think is the best thing observed about him is he's just a font of excuses and blame shifting.
He's whiny. So whiny.
He's so whiny. Tony does a lot of bad things on this show. Let's agree on that. But like, creating this monster and unleashing him upon an unsuspecting world might be among the worst. I want to ask about the tone of this show. I was struggling with, as I was looking back, we can agree that, like, the Godfather films treated this world of the mafia as, like, the quintessential story of America, which is kind of cynical. But the tone from scene to scene of those films is kind of way up here. It's elegiac, it's operatic, and this show ain't that. This is much more ground level, much more workmanlike, and it got into some trouble while it was on the air for humanizing these monsters. But while it humanizes them, I'm not sure that it treats them empathetically or even sympathetically, because it's only too eager to show you how ignorant, how dull-witted, how it goes out of its way to make fun of these mobsters' lack of intellect and lack of refinement in a way that might seem classist, or it's Hollywood writers looking down their noses. I couldn't quite put a finger on what the show was doing in terms of how it treats these characters. Any thoughts?
I think that's a good point, because something that I've always picked up on is how Tony is not upper class. I mean, we see that especially with AJ's girlfriends mm-hmm. and how they are attracted to him, mostly because of the power that is connected, not the money. They sometimes come from houses that are much bigger, from parents that are much richer. I mean, he's definitely living a lifestyle that a majority of Americans don't live, but he's not really in the kind of 1%. At the same time, we're looking at an era where the middle class, which we now don't even really have, is dwindling down. Mm-hmm. And Tony Soprano is in it because he is a mobster. I think your point about this idea of like Hollywood writers kind of looking down on, I definitely get that sense at times, you know, bringing it back to Meadow in those moments when she's at Columbia and she starts to kind of experience these things that are outside of her comfort zone. And she becomes kind of like a social justice warrior at different points. And she's reading more even than what she did in high school. And her parents can't keep up with her anymore. The fact that it's Columbia, I think, says a lot because of just the reputation that Columbia has as a liberal university. When we know that the Soprano family is not left-leaning, I don't know if the writers are necessarily pointing their nose down, but I do think that they're pointing out some of the way that class is constructed by different people. And I kind of like that.
Mm-hmm. I think also to your point, Glenn, about being criticized for being too sympathetic or empathetic of these characters. Anyone who would say that, it probably says more about them than it does about the show, because mm-hmm. it feels like the same conversations we had when it came to something like Mad Men or Breaking Bad, all these difficult men that Tony Soprano more or less spawned in its wake, where it's like, these characters are clearly terrible people. They're all complicit in some way or another. And so to me, I think that it walks a fine line between depicting badness and also making us, you know, feel as though we could be those characters. And it's the same issue that people had with something like The Godfather, where it's like people wanted to be Don Corleone, but also he's a terrible human being. So I think it says more about the audience and the way in which many of us project ourselves into these characters than it does about the show itself.
Yeah, let's talk about the audience, because David Chase, the creator, famously has professed while the show was running and after the show went off the air that he just didn't understand the audience's eagerness for characters to get whacked. And I always found that completely disingenuous, because this guy came from genre TV, right? He came from Kolchak. He came from the Rockford Files. He should know, as much as he's layering character study, nuance, emotional depth over top of this thing, the bones of it are a genre piece. And that means you have to kind of deliver visceral thrills. It's the contact you make with your audience, and you have to know that. That said, this was the first instance that I can remember, again, because message boards, Television Without Pity was a thing, that you'd go on those message boards and you'd find a sector of the audience that really saw Tony as the hero, mm-hmm. not the anti-hero, and rooted for him to end up going through everybody else like a hot knife through butter, becoming king of the mafia and atop a pile of bodies. And they hated any character who got in his way. We would see this again with Breaking Bad. We'd see this again with a lot of shows with anti-heroes, where there's a big, or at least a vocal section of the audience, doesn't get that this guy's a bad dude.
Yeah.
I do want to say, I think it has something to do with James Gandolfini.
Let's get to this.
Just because he is such a brilliant actor. Like, he's so charismatic that it's hard at times not to want to root for Tony. Like, I just thought he embodied that character so well. Like, he's so real. The kind of television that I want to watch is the kind that has me think about my humanness as well. It reminds you that you are also human and have these kind of weird places that you can go. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that we choose every day not to go there. And I think that James Gandolfini was truly a charismatic mm-hmm. person, and you could see his dedication to the role. And I think that that really comes across. But I think that's also kind of the point of the character
yeah.
that sometimes gets, you know, misused or propped up to be, again, a hero, not an anti-hero.
Gandolfini is brilliant. He's got a huge range, if you see him in other things, that you might not necessarily see here. But anyway, Tony is not stupid. He's ignorant, but he's got this emotional intelligence, right? He can read a room, and that's a very important skill in his position. He does project this kind of brute force backed by something like an emotional intelligence, yes?
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that he is going to therapy and has to hide it, too. Mm-hmm. For early on in the show, he's, like, keeping it from everyone because, obviously, there is a stigma to therapy. And I think also at some point, once some of his cohort finds out, they're also worried that, like, that might interfere with their work or he might, like, wind up snitching. So there's all those layers to add to it. And I think we really do see that emotional intelligence come out, especially when he's talking to Dr. Melfi, because she draws it out of him.
How do you feel about the fact that your own mother would have testified against you?
Oh, come on. Will you listen to yourself? I mean, is that right? Wishing her dead? Is that being a good son?
A good son?
Yeah, a good son. I mean, bad sons have...
Bad sons what?
They should die.
That whole relationship to me is just so incredibly fascinating. And I think sometimes the writing kind of veers into this weird territory, you know, where he like has the sex dream about her. And I'm like, do we really have to layer all of these like sort of Freudian things onto it? But overall, I think that that Gandolfini performance, the way in which he can blow up, but then also really just keep everything sort of simmering underneath and just convey something with a glance or like a smirk. It's just one of the greatest performances, I think. I don't think it's a hyperbole to say that like he keeps you on your toes and you're always wondering how he's interpreting whatever interaction he's having at any moment. And yeah, it makes me miss him a lot, just watching it and knowing that, you know, this was what we got from him. I will say, I want to shout out Enough Said, the movie with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, where you get a totally different version of Gandolfini because, he was great.
Yeah, you mentioned Dr. Melfi, and, you know, we get a chance to see how deeply conflicted she is, how disgusted she is by Tony's world, but how fascinated she is, and occasionally even enticed by it. And it seems to me that we talked about how the writers and directors tend to make fun of the mobsters, but it strikes me that the people who come in for the harshest moral critique are the people who, on the show, think of themselves as above Tony's world, but they're still benefiting from it. So his sister Janice, of course, is no gift, also another horrible person. And we talked about Meadows' moral center, which is so performatively, I just took a humanities seminar, you know, and even that gets abraded away. But when we're talking about compromised morality, we have to talk about Carmela, who is the subject of our first question.
Hi, this is Farah, and this is the question about The Sopranos that my husband and I have always debated. Is Carmela just as guilty as Tony?
Yep.
Short and sweet.
Short and sweet. I mean, not just as guilty, maybe, but what do you guys think?
I mean, she's not innocent by any means because she purposely turns away when she knows things are going on. Mm-hmm. And I think we see that most after, spoiler alert, you see her realize that Adriana is gone because of mob activity and most likely Tony's involvement. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't really do anything. I think for Adriana, she really was the most moral character who got kind of caught up in the bad stuff. And so I think Carmela always knows that like she didn't just broke up with Chrissy and like left. But the fact that she never questions it until she runs into Aide's mom, and even then, it just kind of goes to the background again.
Yep.
And I think that's what really, really solidifies all the seasons before, all the episodes before, where Carmela's not really saying much. She's not asking questions because she thinks if she doesn't know the specifics, she's not guilty, but she is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this just goes back to this whole complicity question and how complicit is she? And I'd say as much as one can be without actually having killed anyone or murdered anyone, you know? Like,
yeah.
There's a scene in season two where Tony and Carmela want to get Meadow into Georgetown. And she, like, basically very subtly, but not too subtly, threatens a neighbor's sister who is like a prestigious alumni of Georgetown. And when the woman's like, I don't really want to write a letter of recommendation, I've already done my letters for this season, she's like, well, I want this.
I don't think you understand. I want you to write that letter. Excuse me? I said I want you to write the letter. Are you threatening me? What threatening? I brought you a regard pie and a high school transcript so you could write a letter of recommendation for my little daughter to Georgetown.
Carmela was not above using all of Tony's connections, even if it was in the most subtle or like insidious way possible, not directly explicit about it. She knows that she can do that, and she knows she has that power. And so she's absolutely, like, I wouldn't say, obviously not as guilty, but she's definitely complicit and is, as Tony tells her several times while they're fighting, is very happy to, like, spend all of his money and be a stay-at-home mom. Like, she doesn't have a job, you know?
Yeah. There's certainly a parallel here because, yes, she is benefiting from Tony's world, even though she pretends that she's not. And then in the first season, she has this storyline with a priest where a part of her is seeking Catholic absolution, but she's trying to sample it. She's trying to take advantage of it without committing to it, and yet trying to seek absolution over something she knows she is guilty of. And you know, Tony's guilty too, but he's seeking absolution, you know, in the therapy room, and he is untroubled by any kind of religious concern. She is, and yet she manages to push that down if it means she can keep going on with her lifestyle. Now, our second question is about the series' much-debated ending scene in the finale. Yep, we're going to be talking about it. It comes from Pamela.
I think that The Sopranos has pretty much the perfect series finale. I know it's kind of Thelma and Louise-y, but in my mind, Sopranos' series finale is just perfect. And I would be curious to hear your thoughts.
We should say, okay, so the Sopranos family goes to a diner. Tony comes in, puts Don't Stop Believin' on the jukebox. They're eating communion wafers / onion rings in a whole, in a very religious overtone kind of way. He's looking over the plastic encased menu with lots of pictures of food on it. And after Meadow has a very tough time parallel parking.
she reminds me of myself. I hate parallel parking.
Right.
We cut to black. Don't stop. I assumed, like many, that something had gone wrong with the TV, that HBO had cut out. What'd you guys think of the ending?
I think that the ending sums up this television series, and it has aged really well. Mm-hmm. This idea of cutting to black is something that at that time was pretty experimental in a way that especially the second part of the final season really is. Parts of season 5, which is my personal favorite, where we get into the dream sequences. And I think that there's no appropriate way to give real closure to the story that we have experienced for so many episodes, gone through so many deaths, traumas, ridiculous storylines. There's really no other ending I could imagine that would satisfy anyone. So I think this idea of it being in a wholesome moment with the family, something that we don't really get often in the show, it kind of ends on a happy note if you think about it. Obviously, there's theories on what that fade to black means. And I watched, when I first finished my initial watch of the show, I did watch like quite a few YouTube videos that like analyzed every second, every shot. Like, that's fun. Like, I like listening to other people's theories both ways, you know, like what happened or whatnot. But it really does bring the show to a nice ending. Maybe I would think differently if I was, yeah, one of those people watching it on HBO. And then all of a sudden I'm like, what's going on? But I think it's a nice completion to the story.
For me, the genius of that ending is the fact that the show, in many complicated ways, wants you to align itself with Tony. There's a scene earlier in season 6 before Bobby, who's like one of his side guys and is married to Janice by the end of the show, before he dies, spoiler, where he and Tony are talking and having like a real heart to heart. And he's like,
I mean, yeah, our line of work, it's always out there. You probably don't even hear it when it happens, right?
That foreshadowing is, to me, sort of aligning ourselves. Like, so we know that this is what happens. We know that Tony's dead because it fades to black. And so we are experiencing this through Tony's point of view. If you're going to read it that way, I think that that's just like a brilliant thing to do. And there are ways in which some might see it as like a cop-out, but I think it's kind of crucial. We've seen all of these horrible deaths, and I think it's crucial that we don't see this death on screen.
And I've always taken that as David Chase giving the audience a polite, if not necessarily, but F you. Like, as you mentioned, Shay, there are lots of dream sequences, lots of dream episodes that kind of point towards some kind of quasi-mystical or afterlife. And that last shot, the cut to black, it's not really a fade to black, it's a cut to black, is negating that, saying, absolute, nope, there's nothing, and it's all members only jacket guy's fault. And that's it. We're done. He's out. We want to know what you think about The Sopranos. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH and on Twitter at PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you. Don't stop believing.
Thank you for having me yet again.
And we will see you all tomorrow when we will be talking about the new Sopranos film, The Many Saints of Newark.